Welcome back to the FKT Podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today's episode is brought to you by Jonji, beyond making super durable trail running apparel backed by a 5-year run everywhere guarantee. They also donate 2% of sales to clean water programs in the places we run. Jonji has donated $1 million to clean water and counting. Shop now at jonji.com with code FKT for 10% off. Join me today as I talk with Jasmine Paris, who recently became the first woman to finish the infamous Barclay Marathon, finishing the final loop with only 99 seconds left before the cutoff. Learn how this busy career woman and mom makes time to train, her passion for taking action on climate change, as well as her take on being a role model for women and girls in sports. So you're no stranger to FKTs or race wins, and now you have been the first woman to finish Barclay. I'm just really excited to chat with you today about all of that. And I'd love to start with this year's Barclay and what you did different, because this wasn't your first attempt there.
In terms of what I did differently this year, well, partly I had the experience from the two prior attempts, and that really helped in terms of navigational experience. I think it really helps on Barclay to have experienced the course before. You kind of learn the navigation as you go along. It's not just a case of being good at using a compass and map. It's what you learn on the ground as well. So that was a real help, especially given that the first 2 years I spent quite a lot of time on the course on my own. So I learned by trial and error, and I made a lot of mistakes, and I still made mistakes this year, but I made fewer of them. And when I was about to make some of them, I recognized it early and caught it before it became disastrous. That was one thing. I think just generally, to be honest, I was in a better place when I was training for this year's Barclay. I actually had quite a bit of time off at the end of last year because I was just feeling tired. And I actually, for various reasons, including the kind of some family reasons, but mainly as well the tiredness, I decided not to race the Tour de Gion despite having a place back in September last year. And instead, I gave myself time to just start feeling good again. So I had 2 months when I didn't train. And when I came back to training, end of October, November, I guess things just started to slot into place a bit. I actually probably developed a metatarsal stress fracture, but so I had to do a lot of cross training. But the important thing was I was feeling good again, and I was feeling like I wanted to do it, and I had energy again, and I guess that's what I wanted. So when I came into the early part of this year training for Barclay, I did quite a lot of ascent, more than I think I've done previously. Definitely did more strength training sessions, weighted strength training sessions. It's just more consistent and more use of actual weight rather than just body weight. And I think that really sort of made my legs stronger and helped with a kind of chronic knee problem that I've had. Barclay requires all parts of your body, arms, core, legs, as you're pulling yourself up and kind of having a balance as you make your way down the hill. So all of those things, I think, fed into it. It was a combination of those things. And then for some reason, whether it was partly that or something else beyond that, maybe the energy thing, I just had a belief this year that I was going to do it. Like, it's in some ways inexplainable because it just felt like some confidence that I could do it. And so I definitely went there with a better mindset. I just thought it was possible this year, and I was kind of excited and sort of quietly confident about my chances of being able to finish if the weather was okay. And then the weather forecast came out good, and I felt like I definitely have a chance.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you say about the mental aspect of the wanting, I think that makes a huge difference, especially in something like Barclay. You have to want that 100%. There's no way to go out there and only halfway mentally be invested and do well.
Yeah, I think, yeah, for sure. Because you kind of, more so than any race I've run before, you're definitely going to hit the wall more than once. And you just keep having to climb over it, find your way around it, pick yourself up and keep going. And I don't think you would do that unless you really, really wanted it. It's just too easy to stop all the way. The camp is in the center, and from any point on the course, you can just drop back towards camp in a much more direct route, much easier route. And then obviously when you're in camp, you have the option of just not going out there again.
I think, yeah,
it, unless you really wanted it, you wouldn't do it. You wouldn't put yourself through it.
Yeah, I mean, Laz constructs the race to make it as difficult as possible to finish and as easy as possible to quit.
Yeah.
You mentioned the course familiarity, and yeah, that makes a ton of sense. How much did the course change over your three attempts at Barclay? Were there any big changes this year that took you in a completely different area or really threw you for a loop?
So it changed every year, but it wasn't like huge changes. This year, there was a whole new section. I think people have been openly talked about the fact that a bit went off the map at one point, so you got an extra bit of map. So there was a kind of whole new section. So even the kind of real veterans that have been there many times before didn't know that particular area. So there's been changes every year. One year, a kind of pretty minor change this year. There was an obvious change. There was definitely differences. But the kind of core direction and features, it's very much recognisable as the Barclay course, if you see what I mean. It's not like it's a different race. Quite a few of the books were in different locations this year as well, which meant that on the first loop, we were trying to find the place that the books were hidden. Obviously, that should become less of an issue once you've been round once, because you just should know where they are. It's remarkable how different it can seem when you come in the opposite direction or in the dark or when you're tired. But for the most part, once you've found them once, you should be able to find them again if you're in the right place.
In theory. And then all those rocks and trees start looking alike when you come from the other direction.
Yeah.
You mentioned the weather. Can you talk a little bit about what the weather was like this year?
I'd say it was really good. We were really lucky. The first year I went, it rained a huge amount overnight and lots of people dropped out because I think they weren't really prepared and it got pretty cold. The second year I went, I think the weather was perfect. It couldn't have been any better because it was really cold. But at Barclay, I think that's an advantage because you can wear long trousers and a long sleeve top and you don't get as scratched by brambles and things, but you don't overheat. And it's easier to just put on a layer when you're a bit cold than it is to deal with being too hot out there on the course, I find anyway, personally. And it did also mean the ground was sort of hard and frozen and you weren't sliding around as much. But this year was also really, it just wasn't quite as cold. So I still got a bit hot on occasions this year. It wasn't quite as amazing as last year, but I really can't complain. There was no mist. There was a little bit of rain, but it was pretty insignificant. So yeah, it was pretty amazing, really.
I don't know on your first 2 years, if you had your husband crew you, but I believe he crewed you this year.
Yeah.
Was that something you did different, or was he there the other years as well?
He was there the other years as well, so he knows the whole thing as well. That was really useful because he sort of knew what he'd already worked out what he was doing there and how it all worked. So
yeah, and imagine somebody that knows you well and can really take care of you. I would assume at a certain point you're not even really as capable of articulating your needs as well as, like,
yeah, absolutely,
you should be.
Having somebody that sort of knows you inside out and can kind of predict what you need or can understand your body language from when you're trying to say no, yes, that's hugely valuable. Yeah, and he's just somebody that doesn't faff around. He just, as I say, he's my best friend. He knows me inside out. He knew exactly kind of what I wanted, and I think he was a kind of worried by the fact that I wasn't really eating anything, and he was trying to offer me all these things, but still, you know, we managed to kind of overcome that obstacle. But and you can see it, you see at the end, I think, you know, remember when I sort of collapsed at the gate at the end and he sort of checking whether I was okay, and I couldn't really speak at that point, but I did sort of manage to in some way signal across to him that I was okay, I just needed to breathe. So yeah, you're right that it's a real help having someone that knows you inside out.
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned that you weren't able to really eat. Can you talk a little bit about what you did eat or how much you didn't eat? Like, I'm kind of fascinated by doing something as challenging as Barclay and not being able to eat.
Yeah, it would definitely have been better if I could have eaten more in the later stages. And, you know, I've thought since then how I could do it better, and maybe I should kind of be more open to, you know, I guess I've been open. I've just not really thought about doing it much in the past about kind of liquid nutrition more. Because I certainly struggled with any sort of solid foods later on in terms of being able to swallow them. Everything seemed really dry. And that's a common feature in kind of ultra running. But this time I found it kind of even bigger an issue. But yeah, so the first 2 loops I ate pretty well. You know, in the camp I was eating pasta, porridge, rice pudding, bananas. I still was able to eat bananas till the very end. And that was really excellent. And they always worked very well for me. And I was sort of drinking, you know, coffee or Coca-Cola or tea. Water, obviously. When I was out on the course, I ate, and certainly in the first 2 loops, I ate really well. I think I finished both of my, kind of pretty much finished my food on the first 2 loops, and I had a lot with me. So I was eating, you know, I had sandwiches with cheese and pickle, I had frittata, I had pizza, I had some, you know, flapjack, trail mix, some hot cross buns, which are kind of like, yeah, these kind of sweet breads, obviously some sweets, some chocolate bars, and then gels. Salted nuts, that sort of thing. So just like the standard things that you might take on a long day out on the hills. And I guess on leg three, I was still kind of eating those things, but I was just struggling more. By leg four, by loop four, I was kind of, struggling quite a lot. And on loop five, I did eat something, but not very much at all. Like I guess I've written down somewhere, but it was pretty small amount of food. But somehow, I guess the adrenaline just took over and I found the energy from somewhere, and yeah, it didn't seem to I managed to make it to the end without actually having that much fuel on board.
Yeah, I mean, you reach a point where your body knows that this is a situation where it needs to just push through regardless of fuel intake, and kind of just shuts that off, like, okay, everything's... I think that's just a survival mechanism. Like, your body just shuts down digestion. It's like, okay, we've got enough stored fuel to get through this survival situation we're obviously in. I've seen the video, obviously, of you finishing and just needing to lay there and breathe for a while. And obviously, at some point, you had to hand Laz your pages. What did Laz say to you? What was the first thing he said?
To be honest, I don't really remember. I didn't hand Laz my pages. Somebody got them out of my bag as I was lying there on the floor and gave them to him, presumably because everybody really wanted to know whether they could celebrate the fact that I'd finished or not. Because obviously, not actually finished until Laz has checked your pages. So
he's checked your pages, yeah.
Yeah, so I think everybody stood there wanting to, excited that I'd finished, but nobody for sure knew that I had finished because I was incapable of saying anything. So yeah, somebody, I think it was Conrad, got the pages out of my bag and handed them to Laz. And then I didn't have a specific, it is a bit blurry afterwards, but I didn't have a specific memory of him, what he said specifically. I mean, I know that when I was lying there, I think he said something like, do we need medical, at the point when I was lying on the floor, which is ironic because as far as I know, there's no real medical there. But, and obviously handed me the button to press to say that was easy. So yeah, I knew that he was pleased. Like, you could tell looking at him that he was pleased. Like, everything about him said that he was delighted and that he was, I think, impressed as well. So I got that from it. It was almost like he didn't need to say it, you know? So
right.
He might have said something specific, but I don't actually remember any specific words. I just know that he was there and he was pleased. I could tell that for sure.
Right. For anybody that is listening that doesn't know, like, Laz's whole thing over the whole course of the Barkley is that the Barkley is too tough for a woman to finish. And yet, I think that he has secretly been eagerly awaiting a woman to finish.
Yeah.
And so I think that, yeah, when you say you could see it in his body language, I feel like that. Yeah. Plus, I mean, you had a pretty dramatic 99-second to spare finish.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like he and I, you know, it felt like we had a bit of history there. You know, I've been there twice before. The first year, it was a fairly, like, last minute finished my fun run the first year, so it was not too dissimilar then, because I got a bit lost coming off the last hill that year. And then last year, obviously, I finished four loops, but it was over time. And I remember I tried to give him my pages, do you want to look at my pages, because I, you know, it was like, there's no point, he didn't do the loop, so he didn't even look at them. And I was still proud of the fact that I'd been around and collected all these pages, but as far as he was concerned, it was over time, so it didn't count anyway, so there's no point. But he did say to me at that point, he said, do you still think you can do it? And I smiled at him and said, yeah. So it was kind of nice to go back and close that chapter and, yeah, restart our conversation in a way. Nothing needed to be said.
What kind of a takeaway do you have from this experience, this whole thing with several attempts at Barkley? Has it taught you anything about yourself, or maybe enlightened you onto, like, goals you have outside of Barkley?
Well, I mean, I still feel really happy, like, thinking about it. I still feel like so a real sense of satisfaction and kind of personal, you know, it was a personal ambition of 3 years. And I think it took a lot when he came to it. I don't even know that it was particularly like my best run ever. I just think it was my best display of stubbornness, determination, resilience, perseverance. I don't know, but I stuck it out, you know, and I'm proud of that. And so I still, whenever I think about it, I feel really proud. And I think that does kind of give you a certain confidence going into the rest of life. Like, you just, you know, you sort of remember to yourself, I did that. Like, other situations, I guess you always have that stress kind of to draw on when you kind of come to other situations that challenge you. And, you know, it's a nice sort of thing in the bank that kind of gives you the confidence in the rest of life. And it doesn't have to necessarily be a race, but I'm talking about is just something that kind of frightens you, challenges you. It's nice to think back that you managed to finish that personal dream that you had. I think for me, the thing that I was, you know, I really even surprised myself with how far I managed to dig in those last, you know, but both kind of finishing that last loop, but especially in those last 10 minutes. Like, I thought I'd given everything and far beyond already in that race. And then somehow in those last minutes when it looked like it was all going to finish with me finishing seconds over time, I managed to pull something else out from somewhere somewhere deeper down that I just genuinely didn't know I was capable of kind of tapping into. So I think that was like a real discovery for me. You know, I'd always said you can do great things if, you know, you believe in yourself and you really give it a go. But I think that surprised even me. So that was a nice thing to come away with from that.
You know, these voluntary hardships, we put ourselves in a position to do hard things that are completely optional. And they really do, I feel like, give us that chance to get a glimpse of what we're really capable of. So when we're faced with life's challenges, the ones that are not optional, you have that memory. Like you said, it's in the bank. Okay, well, I've done something very hard before.
Yeah.
And I can do it again. I have what it takes.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we're now several months past the Barclay. How is your recovery gone? Your physical recovery? Were you pretty destroyed after the race? Or
I'd say not that destroyed. I mean, I guess for a few days I had pretty swollen legs, obviously, and that time we sort of flew via first to New York to see my brother and his family kind of on our way home and then back to the UK, and that's not great for kind of swollen legs and blistered toes. But those things all healed pretty quickly. I mean, I think we got back on the Monday, and on the Wednesday I cycled into work, so I felt fine to do that. I was a bit slow on the uphill, but and I started kind of running easy again about 2 weeks after Barclay, just really super easy. But I've actually only just started training again this week. This is my kind of first week of proper training. I actually did a kind of a race a few days of racing actually a couple of weeks ago. But again, it was just kind of, it was for fun, and so there was no pressure. So I've only just started training again. I just gave my body kind of enough time to kind of listen to it and just do what felt right for a bit, you know, just to kind of take it super easy. Obviously, I've been in some cycling and some swimming and things as well. Overall, I feel okay. I think, to be honest, if anything, I've got a bit of tiredness left over just from all the stuff that's come afterwards. There's been quite a lot of media attention, and you know, that's been really wonderful, and you know, it's been very inspiring for me to hear stories and to do, you know, chat with kids and things like that. That's been like really, really wonderful. But it's also, you know, another kind of thing, kind of very, you know, another thing that's competing for my time, I guess, alongside work and small children and running. And so it's just, you know, just trying to find the recovery time, I think, has been the biggest challenge. And probably I could still do with a few weeks of really long sleeps and just to kind of complete the recovery. But overall, I feel pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, that was actually my next question, was what's been the mental process and recovery like, especially with all this media attention and fame that comes on the heels of doing something like this?
Yeah, so I think I sort of touched on it already, but as I say, I found it's been really wonderful, especially the interactions I've had with people, hearing people's stories, talking to people one-on-one. I love that, and that was my experience when I was lucky enough to start the elite race at the London Marathon, the elite ladies race. But just my experience there, supporting people, seeing people taking part, talking to people, that was really wonderful. I feel like it's such a privilege to be able to be in a position where you can inspire people. I feel like I'm incredibly fortunate. And with that, I guess, comes some responsibility to try and do that well and to make use of those opportunities. So I guess that's part of the reason I've been so open to doing interviews and things, is because the feedback has genuinely been that people have found it very inspiring, I guess, the story. As I say, the best bits have been things like talking to people and talking to children. But there is some balance, trying to balance all that with, as I say, working full-time and having small children. So, yeah, I'm still working it out, really, because it's not like I'm a professional athlete and I don't have someone to do all the PR for me. So I just get these messages via all media channels that people can work out how to contact me on my university email or Twitter and things. And it's just trying to even just manage all those messages at the start was quite challenging, but I'm getting there. And as I said, there's been lots of a really incredible side to it as well.
I don't know if you're introverted or extroverted. I'm extremely introverted. And I know that every time I do an FKT or something, I'm afraid to open my email. I'm like, I don't want to respond, and I just don't for a while until I'm mentally ready, because I don't have somebody managing it, and I'm like, I just can't deal with this right now. So you mentioned your kids a couple of times, and I know, listening to some other interviews, you didn't become a runner until you were an adult.
Yeah,
but as a child, it sounded like you got to go out hiking and were in the hills a lot with your family. And was curious if that is something that you and your husband are introducing to your children. Are you taking them out? And maybe what do your kids think about all this crazy shenanigans that their mother does?
I guess, firstly, they've just grown up with us both going running. And I guess they're just so used to it. That's something that they don't question. They don't try to persuade me not to go out for a run in the early morning, for example. They just accept that. But at the same time, I think my daughter, who smells sticks, was mildly impressed by the Barkley thing, just because kids at school said that they'd seen me on telly and the class kind of drew me a card together, which was wonderful. But that sort of, I guess, being mildly impressed lasted probably about 10 minutes and then that was over. And my son, who's three, had no concept of it at all, except that we'd been away and then we came back and what had we brought back type thing. It was good to see us and give us a cuddle. So for them, you know, I don't think they really, it doesn't really affect them that much, because most of my training I do early in the morning, and I tend to get back in time to still drop my son at nursery. And then in the evenings, it's just completely family time. And then if I do work, I do it once I'm in bed. So the running doesn't affect them that much. When you, in terms of what we do with them in the hills, yeah, absolutely. We're already going hiking as a family. And this summer, actually, for the summer holiday, for 4 days of that, we're going to go like hut to hut. So that's going to be a bit of a, we'll see how we get on doing that in the Austrian high mountains. And we found a kind of an area with fairly safe walking trails and huts that are pretty close together, and I'm really excited to see how we manage. So I think they'll get lots of experiences like that. Just the last weekend, actually, we were supporting somebody doing a Ramsey round, which is a kind of a circuit around the 24-hour challenge up here in Scotland or around the Glen Nevis area. And there's three legs to this challenge. And my husband was actually supported the second leg and I supported the third leg. But rather than changing over at the classic changeover point in the valley, he actually ran on up the first Munro on the third leg. And in the morning, whilst he was running, I hiked up there with a friend and her kids as well. So we had the four kids almost at the top of a Munro when the men caught up. And we just, this flying changeover of support up on the hill, and whilst the person that we were supporting, you know, ran on. So it's totally different to the old days when you would be well rested and everything prepared and everything planned out. Instead, now you're carrying a big rucksack with all the stuff for the family and all the picnics and everything else, and your running stuff is somewhere crammed away, and then you have to do this very rapid changeover and throwing out your waterproof and things on the heather and quickly trying to get the bag from the other support runner. So yeah, it's really wonderful. But so, yeah, we didn't, the kids, I think, were out on the hill for 10 hours on Saturday. Me and my husband, we were both out for 15 hours at this kind of crossover point with the children on either side. So yeah, that was really wonderful. So in answer to your question, absolutely, they're already doing days in the hills. And I think they seem to really like being outside as well.
Well, I hope that your hut trip goes well. I hope they continue to enjoy being out in the hills. A couple of years ago, you stopped running for Innovate and you started running for Green Runners. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your involvement with Green Runners.
Yeah, I'd love to. So I was a co-founder of Green Runners. Yes, we're all kind of volunteers, and we came together to set Green Runners up just because of our concern about the situation in terms of the climate crisis, and I thought that we could make a difference in starting within our own running community. The aim of the Green Runners is to inform, inspire, empower runners to make greener decisions in terms of their running. So the kind of concept is based around the four pillars, thinking about how you move, and that's mainly how you travel to races, to be honest. So for me, as I say, I'm trying not to fly to races. Barkley was the exception, but in general, trying to travel by land and sea, and for races in Europe, I've certainly been doing that, including the World Trail Running Champs last year, and I'll travel to the Tour de Gion this year by train. Then thinking about how you fuel, sort of more of a plant-based diet, thinking about how you kit up, and for me, that meant I wanted to reuse, recycle, repair kit rather than getting new kit, and that was part of the reason I stepped away from being an ambassador for a kind of company making kits. So, and rather than in suggesting to people that they needed new kit all the time, I preferred to show them that I was wearing repaired shoes, for example. And there's lots of information on that on the Green Runners website, how you can fix your kit, for example, with Pair Ups. It's a company that has lots of good examples of videos and things for that. And then finally, how you speak out. So the Green Runners, I think that's one of the most important thing, and that's generally that goes outside running, how we speak out about and send the message to our leaders, the people leading our countries in terms of that they need to take better, faster action on climate change. So within our sport, it's calling out high carbon sponsors, for example, I think we need to be calling out systems that are set up to send people racing all over the world to just be able to qualify for a particular high stakes race that people want to go to. I think we need to just be thinking about, yeah, as I say, just about trying to be conscious of the fact that we run in the mountains and the hills because we love being outside in these beautiful natural places, but we also need to protect them. And that starts close to home. So with our own actions and then what we can do collectively to call for change. So hopefully that roughly explains what the Green Runners are about.
Yeah, I think that's a fabulous organization. And I assume this is like a UK-based organization.
Yeah, I mean, we now have Green Runner members all over the world. So you can check out thegreenrunners.com, the website. The main thing really is about, you know, the idea is you make a pledge, you pay a small donation, and then you become a member and you can get a badge and you can ask, you know, a small amount for a badge to be sent to you, which you can sew onto your bag, your kit, so that other people recognize you as a Green Runner at events and things as well. And so you kind of develop this sense of community. But the key thing for me is making the pledge and acting on the pledge. That's the key thing. So whether people, you know, it's fantastic to have lots of members and we have over 1,000 now, but the key thing is acting on the pledge. So as I said, there's lots of good, useful information on the Green Runners website and things like, you know, as an example, the Green Runners launched a petition when the UTMB announced Datcher as a headline sponsor. And just kind of, as I say, I think that's just one of the many examples in our sport where I think we need to be, yeah, fighting for what we really want our sport to represent and who we want to kind of sponsor our major sporting events. So the Green Runners will give a voice to the running community, and it's very much a kind of two-way thing, so that you know, people want to get involved. That's fantastic. We very much welcome that, and lots of ideas, and again, very much welcome.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's really key, like protecting the places that we like to run and hike and be out in, you know, and how our actions are directly impacting that. Well, before we wrap up, I would just love it if you could talk a little bit about like women in sports and like maybe your motivations and how that's changed. Because obviously you mentioned earlier, like, that you feel honored to be an inspiration. And so like now you are kind of this icon for women in sports, you know? Yeah. So maybe just like how you perceive that and your relationship to that.
Yeah.
And how that's changed.
I find it's really wonderful. I'm so happy that I have managed to, as I said, acquire this state and the role model, kind of an icon inspiration for women. I guess I never really set out to be that, though. I think I've always just done what I wanted and believed that I was capable of it. So maybe it's just me, really. I never really thought I was any different to a man when I'm running these races. And so I just look at it and say, do I think I can, for example, the Spine race, I went into it thinking I could win this, the thing goes well, and that's what I want to do. I wasn't thinking about winning as a woman. I was thinking about trying to win the thing overall. So, and with Barclay, again, it was just like, I want to do this. I want to do this for me because I think it's possible to finish. And the aspect of being a woman and knowing, I knew that Laz had said a woman couldn't finish it, and I thought a woman can finish it. But ultimately, my main thing going there was just to prove it to myself that I could do it. So I think it was always a kind of byproduct of that I've ended up as this kind of inspiration for women. But I think it's wonderful. I'm so glad that's happened. And because especially we know there's a huge dropout rate of girls in sport at school, actually pretty young, even in primary school, already dropping out from sports. I heard the stories people writing to me saying their daughter was going to drop out of football because she was there the only one with all the boys type thing. And so it's really wonderful to kind of be an example, maybe, that that's not the case, and that we can kind of that girls can continue to do sports in a kind of maybe traditionally male dominated sports that we can do really well. So I think that's fantastic and also inspiring, you know, women of all ages. So, you know, we know that women that now, once they have a kind of family and lots going on, then often don't have a sport and aren't very active. And it's, I think, really good for mental health and kind of getting away. And personally, I find as a mum that it's really good for me to have some me time, and actually running now is my only time when I can just be me and just be the old Jasmine, you know, before I had kids and before I had a career that kind of was all consuming and before all of this stuff, it was just like me on the hills. So I can go back to being that when I'm a runner. I think that's really good for me once a day to sort of get out there and have that headspace, and I always come back happier and calmer and with more of a sense of perspective. Mountains have always given me that. This sort of feeling of peace and perspective and all the worries that have sort of go away. So if I can kind of be an example and just get people, especially women, out there doing something for them and being active, I think it's going to be incredibly good for their mental health and their confidence. And it's not about everybody going out and doing Barclay or any kind of extreme challenges. It's just kind of going out there and having fun, I think. And I think as a kind of follow-up to that, they will find that they maybe want to take on some challenge. It might be just doing the 5K or something, but I think if they go out there and give it a go, then yeah, be incredibly, they'll be surprised at what they're actually capable of. Probably end up building up to a marathon or an ultra or whatever else. So the way that a little bit like happened with me.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate you making the time.
You're welcome. You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again, Jasmine, for coming on the show. You can read more about the Green Runners pillars and make your pledge at greenrunners.com and follow Jasmine's adventures on Instagram at JasmineParis_BellRunner.